Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
Absolutely.
If we're uncomfortable
Absolutely.
Talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
This is Buffalo Toronto Public Media NPR, and this is What's Next. I'm Jay Moran, joined by India Walton. India, of course, now with Roots Action, Senior Advisor with Roots Action. It's quite a title.
Isn't it?
It most certainly is. What does it mean?
Well, it's the same title as Elon Musk.
Whoa.
So it must mean that I'm
You're the richest woman in the world?
I don't know. Or maybe I'm going to get on a rocket ship or something. No, but, you know, it means that I'm in thought partnership with my colleagues over at Roots Action. And we talk a lot about policy, about strategy, just pushing our representatives in D.C. to be anti-war, to stop the endless wars, cut the military budget and things like that. But I also do a significant amount of media as a part of my role as well.
Oh, and so you're the face often or the...
Not the face.
The whisperer, maybe?
Maybe the whisperer.
Yeah.
I believe that when it comes to critique of the Democratic Party, I am a person who's willing to say things that a lot of people will not.
Let's critique the Democratic Party then. Let's take some time here to do just that.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe November was a bit of a critique for the Democratic Party.
It should have been a wake-up call, but it seems like they're still very much asleep.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
What do you hear? What are you seeing? What doors aren't opening? People aren't listening? What do you have?
I mean, we're just not seeing the response to the first Trump administration, right? A lot of folks are sort of complacent. They're going with the flow. There's no real resistance. I mean, even the fact that Chuck Schumer voted for the budget in the way that happened, it's very confusing.
It is interesting to see the senators' recent New York polling went down significantly after that vote.
And I mean, even outside of the presidential election, the way there was this attack on both Cori Bush and Jamal Bowman for their support of ending the genocide in Gaza, right? And they were replaced with other Democrats, but they're not going to be working class champions who are going to stand up for the right thing. I mean, Cori Bush slept on the steps of the White House to preserve eviction protections during the pandemic. Not the White House, the Capitol, you know what I mean.
Absolutely. Yeah. So you're seeing kind of an internal backlash of sorts. I mean, it's interesting the way you describe what's going on inside the Democratic Party. I mean, I guess what you're suggesting or just stating outright that the leadership of the party is rejecting a move to the left.
Well, I believe that Democrats do more to defeat progressives than they do to take care of the Republicans, right? I mean, you know, there was this sort of line of thinking that they were going to be able to somehow convert suburban Republicans and make them more moderate and have them vote Democrat if they just told the line. And it's just not true.
You mentioned suburban Republicans. That's an interesting place to maybe take a little deep dive in there.
Mm-hmm.
So you're obviously taking a good hard look at the electorate and how these groups are assembled and what their, I guess, for lack of a better term, groupthink offers. What do we know about that group, that suburban Republican, for lack of a better term? I guess for a while we used to call them soccer moms, maybe. Is that what we used to talk, like the Clinton years used to be the conversation? What are we seeing inside there? What's going on? What's driving that groupthink?
They care about their wealth and the comfort of their lives.
Is there, are they missing a message that they can have their wealth and the comfort of their lives, and yet there could be other more progressive things going on in this country?
I think what is being experienced now with inflation still rampant, with the tariffs and the trade wars, folks, you know, the stock market, folks are losing significant chunks of their retirements. I think that people are experiencing that this is not about a party that is going to save working class in middle America, which middle America is for the most part disappearing, right? It's the 1% in all the rest of us. And my hope is that in 4 years, if we survive this, we will have been able to build up enough class consciousness to figure out that together, collectively, we can provide for everyone, and it doesn't have to be an us versus them.
It's interesting you said about the thinning out of the middle, so to speak. We just recently had a program on about housing here in Erie County, and you're seeing just that, that there is a widening of expensive housing here in Erie County, and there's a widening of housing that is, you know, I hate to use the term substandard, but mm-hmm. it's most certainly low-income housing, and that middle ground is long gone. Is that a message that's getting out?
I think it is. People are feeling it in their pockets, and the difficulty for me is that I have seen with my own eyes that it doesn't have to be that way. But there are a lot of people who believe that one day they're going to be rich.
Mm-hmm.
So they're resistant to phrases like tax the rich or the wealthy should pay their fair share because they're worried about their taxes, when what's actually happening is that the wealthy are keeping their money and the people who are being taxed are the working class people.
You know, it's one of the nice things about being old is that I've realized I'm not going to be rich. So I wish I knew that 40 years ago. I probably would have been a bit different. But, you know, as we were talking about that, it's also another thought about education.
Mm-hmm.
If education, tell me if I'm wrong about this. Education is never, we're never going to be able to see education, especially of lower income people, education being, you know, always the great thought that this is what's going to lift us all up. But education will never be equal, or we'll never see real equity in education with the current funding model. Do you agree with that?
So I used to be a school nurse. And I think a part of the issue with schools and funding is not the funding that comes into the school system. The Buffalo public school system has a budget that's larger than the entire city of Buffalo.
Right.
We spend a lot of money.
So do you think there's enough resources there?
There's enough resources inside of the school system.
Okay.
There's not enough resources inside the homes.
Mm.
We are expecting children who are housing insecure, who are food insecure, sometimes malnourished, tired, they're primary caregivers for siblings while their parents work, they're experiencing community violence. How do you expect a person who is in fight or flight mode all the time to come into a building and sit for 6 hours and be able to learn? And then add on top of that, the nutrition in the school is awful. Kathy Hochul vetoed the Good Food Purchasing Program that would have prioritized local, sustainable agriculture and getting fresh foods into the schools, right? She vetoed that. But then she said, well, we'll give all kids free breakfast and lunch. But it comes from Sysco, a corporation that brings in prepackaged, overprocessed foods into our schools instead of letting the commissary cook high quality, nutritious foods. We're getting rid of the arts. We're cutting recess and physical activity. I mean, it's not about putting more money into the school building itself. It's about prioritizing the health and well-being and safety of the entire community so that when the kids come into the building, they're ready to learn.
At the same time, the school district is being asked to do, like you said, feed children, to do more. So what you're saying then is the priority, we're getting it backwards here, I guess, or sideways, for lack of a better term.
It's so backwards. And I mean, even the fact that we're still busing children out of their neighborhoods. Mm. Why? Right? Like, that was a pre-integration thing, but we're not integrating schools anymore. Many of those buildings are still 75%+ Black children, right? The more affluent and other families, all of their kids either go to Olmsted, City Honors, or they put them in privates. So why not have the children be able to walk to school in their community, to be able to access that school building after school hours and have something to do in the evening time? Because we've seen the gutting of youth services in the city. If you look at the budget, right? Police get plenty of money. Youth services, very little. Very little, comparatively.
What's stopping? What do you say is stopping the, I mean, we've heard about the neighborhood school idea. I mean, it's not a new idea, right? That was the way schools were always set up. And of course, that for now, what we're over a half century of busing here in the city of Buffalo. What's stopping? I know I've heard inklings throughout the years of, hey, why don't we, let's get back to having neighborhood schools. What's stopping it?
I think a part of the barrier most likely is enrollment is down.
Mm.
You know, a lot of folks are choosing charters these days. And like I said, a lot of people are just going private. There's also been an uptick in homeschooling, especially since COVID. So I think it would have to take a lot of thought to sort of make the numbers work. And then we've also sold off a significant portion of the neighborhood schools. So, yeah.
There's a lot there. India Walton with us on What's Next Today. India, we'll keep mentioning not running for office. But most certainly here willing to share her experience, her expertise, and her views on a lot of different matters. And we most certainly are appreciative of it. Let's get back maybe for a little national discussion here, since Roots Action, that's what you're doing as a senior advisor there as well. Let's start off with your advice to the Democratic Party that is it wrong for me to say thumped in November? Is that wrong? Sometimes I get in trouble when I use verbs like that.
My advice to the Democratic Party is that voters know what we need, and people vote based on the perception of who is going to provide for those needs. And people are not stupid. We see what's going on, and you should probably take the advice of people who talk to voters and not of consultants, because nobody cared about Beyonce.
Mm.
It didn't translate into votes. People did care about Palestine, and those people stayed home, and people care about jobs. They care about their labor union. They care about job security. And there was not a message out of the Democratic Party for people who care about those things. Now, out of the Republican Party, it might have all been lies.
Mm-hmm.
But at least
it resonated.
At least it resonated.
Labor unions, you mentioned that. Interesting. I'll invite you into the tariff discussion here. We can add more to what is, is leaving the electorate bewildered, the tariff situation. But yet, we saw local auto worker unions saying, oh, the tariffs are a great thing. What about the tariff situation? What do you see of it? What do you make of what you're hearing and seeing?
I have a relative who works at a car dealership, and immediately when the tariffs went into place, their sales dropped.
Mm.
No one's buying cars. I think that American retail is going to take a major hit. There's this whole thing going on now with the producers in China on TikTok giving their WhatsApp number and saying, just buy directly from the manufacturers, cut out the middleman. So I think that people perceived it to be something that was going to work, right? Because the idea is that, well, it's going to somehow make more money for the United States, but also it's going to bring back manufacturing jobs. But then on the other hand, it's 2025, and where are you going to get this workforce who's going to work a 12-hour day in a hot factory for a low wage to produce your widget?
That's an interesting take on it, for sure. What about what you saw? You went to the Democratic National Convention, didn't you?
I did.
What'd you see there?
Oh, my God. I saw a tale of two Democratic parties.
Two Democratic parties?
Yes. I spent the first 3 days over at the Chicago Teachers Union with the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. Bernie Sanders, former Senator Nina Turner, Ro Khanna, talking about policy, prioritizing the needs of working class people, having serious conversations. The final 3 days I spent at the DNC. Inside, it was the largest party I'd ever seen.
Mm.
There was confetti falling from the ceiling. There was one celebrity after another. It was a very jovial and happy mood, as if Kamala had already won the election. And then on the outside of the convention center, I saw the over-policing of peaceful protesters exercising their First Amendment rights. While when we say that we are the party that is going to protect us against fascism, at the same time, you are over-policing and punishing folks for expressing themselves. I saw in the lobby of the convention center delegates who were crying because they were denied an opportunity to speak at the convention because they were part of the uncommitted movement.
Kamala Harris, of course, lost, and lost pretty convincingly. Did she lose because she wasn't a good candidate, or did she lose on policy?
She lost because they skipped the primary. We didn't choose her as our candidate. Maybe if there had been a primary, we would have. But I think to give her 90 days to convince the electorate of who she is and what she believes in is impossible, because to many voters, she was simply an extension of Joe Biden. And also, I think that the uncommitted movement was powerful. There was a base there. And had she just said, I'm going to stop supplying weapons to Israel, I think we would have had a different outcome. I believe that.
A lot of the polling numbers, though, leading up to the election showed that it was going to be close, and it wasn't.
Well, anytime someone brings up a poll, I always bring up who the pollsters poll. They're calling likely voters. They're calling people who still have landline phones, people like me, who, if they do get a hold of my cell phone number, if I don't recognize the number, I'm not answering it.
Right.
So the people that they are speaking to tend to trend older and more sort of middle of the road. Right. I think they missed a lot of people in those polls.
You mentioned it earlier. 4 years from now, there will be another presidential election. Maybe.
Hopefully.
I kind of paraphrased your words there. Sorry about that, or appropriated them. But it's a long time. There's a lot of time ahead. Starting today, what needs to be done? If it's the Democratic Party or some other party, what do they need to do if they want to gain power in this country to perhaps be the ones back in the White House?
I mean, first of all, some of these people need to just move out of the way. stop preventing those of us who want to do the work from doing it. And also, we need to start calling out people who are presenting themselves as Democrats, but who aren't doing anything for working class people, who are taking money from the pharmaceutical lobby, the real estate lobby, the corporate lobby. If you are funded by the same people who are funding Donald Trump, then you have the same interests. That's bottom line. Who are you beholden to? I think the other thing that really needs to happen is Citizens United. If we don't get big money out of politics, there's no way that we're going to get a gaggle of grassroots, authentic, working class candidates into any office, because the challenge of overcoming that flood of money into these elections is insurmountable.
That's when you talk about that, the big money that's in politics, it does paint a dystopic picture for sure. At the same time, I know you're not going to quit, and I know a lot of people aren't going to quit, but I'm interested, and it's a long ways away, and it's probably the wrong question to ask when it comes to potential candidates already, mm-hmm. but I'm wondering if already, I mean, you meet lots of people, more than I know. Can you see candidates emerging here, or a candidate, somebody that you say, keep an eye on this person or keep an eye on these people? You got somebody in mind? Or do you want to withhold on that? It's a little too early to be starting to play the personality game here.
Well, I can probably say this because this is a local show, mm-hmm. but keep an eye on Ro Khanna.
Okay. All right. Why?
Just the way he's moving. I think there's a slow ascent into leadership in the party that's happening with him right now. I wonder about David Hogg, maybe not a presidential run, but maybe a congressional run. It'll be interesting. I know that Justice Democrats is actively recruiting, so we'll see.
Okay. Where should people look for more? I mean, hopefully you've intrigued people here with your conversation today. Where should people be turning for more to find out more? We try to give them as much as we can. Well, yeah. I mean, I know, unfortunately, we fall short in the media here. But what about that? Where could people turn to find out what you want them to see?
Yeah, I mean, visit rootsaction.org anytime on Progressive Hub. There's always links to articles and information. The Zero Hour is a really good podcast that talks a lot about these topics. You can always follow me on social media. I think I'm just India Walton.
Right.
On Twitter and Facebook. And look for reliable, credible sources of information and take it with a grain of salt and assess it with a very critical lens.
A critical lens. That's we all could use a little critical lens, that's for sure. All right, you've got about a minute to go. I already know the answer, but I'm going to ask you to expand on it. Do you have hope? Do you have hope for this country?
Eternal.
Yeah?
I have eternal.
Why?
Hope.
Why?
Because I know people. Because I know people, and because I have survived so much nonsense, so much trauma and violence and sadness, that there has to be something better on the other side.
I'm going to leave it at that. I'm not going to ask you one more question. You have been great, as always, for joining us here. India Walton, as always, thanks for being with us on What's Next.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Ahead, we have a conversation on Buffalo State's Post-Production Diversity Initiative with Dorothea Bramer, Robin Lazara, and Renato Graham. This is What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
The headlines don't stop. The world keeps moving, and through it all, you need news and information you can trust. That's where we come in. WBFO is now Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR. Same station, same trusted journalism, just with a new name. From Morning Edition to All Things Considered, from Group Chat to Friday Night Lights, from What's Next to the BBC, we bring you the stories and smart conversations that matter. No spin, no nonsense, just the perfect mix of news, information, and entertainment. Listen anytime on the BTPM Listen app or btpm.org.
From the fringes of the mainstream to the local music you love, listen to Buffalo Toronto Public Media The Bridge Monday through Thursday, 8 p.m. to midnight on BTPM NPR at 88.7 or from your smart speaker.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the BTPM Listen app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@btpm.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Welcome to What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR. Today, we're going to be talking about the Post-Production Diversity Initiative. It's out of Buffalo State University. And with us are three guests. Dorothea Bramer is a longtime Buffalo State University professor, right? Long time, is that a good way to describe you at these days?
No, actually, I just started about 6 years ago. I don't
know. Long time film professional then here in Western New York.
Yes.
We can use that for sure. Also with us, Robin Lazara, the project manager. Robin, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
And also a long time professional as well, but an individual who's actually taking part in this program. It's Renato Graham. Renato, thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here.
All right, let's first of all lay it out. I'll let you go with it, Dorothea, here. Just overview, what is the Post-Production Diversity Initiative?
The Post-Production Diversity Initiative is a year-long program that is supposed to assist participants in entering the post-production field in entry-level positions. And it's designed to help people that traditionally have been barred is kind of a hard word, but didn't have
been impeded.
Easy access to the post-production field. So there's still an issue with a lack of representation in the post-production field, not just editing, but also music mixing and all kinds of different editing. They're all are not representative of the society that we live in. And I do believe that to have a healthy media landscape, you need to have a healthy representation of the people that are actually living in that society. So when that grant came along, I was like, ooh, that sounds really cool. It was like a New York diversity, workforce diversity grant for specifically the film industry. And I called up the program officers there, and I said, would you consider something like post-production? And they were like, yeah, people don't normally apply for that. It's more like for people that want to be gaffers or something along those lines. But they said, yeah, but yes, we would definitely be interested. It took about at least 10 months to apply for this grant. Now we are the only initiative that has been funded by the New York State Workforce grant that focuses on post-production. And I think, Robin, you correct me if I'm wrong, but Shaylin, our program officer, also said we were the only one in Buffalo that got funded by them. I'm not sure. But anyways, we're the only one that is doing post-production. And our thinking was that we wanted to address three areas. Mentorship, because mentorship is so invaluable and important in the field, more important than getting an A in your class or something like that. Mentorship, like somebody who's already in the field, and networking. The second element was networking, opportunities to network so that people can enter the field through conversation and feeling more comfortable and understanding how the ecosystem works in the post-production world. And then the third one is skill-based. A lot of big companies such as Netflix require people who want to become editors to have a certificate in Avid Media Composer, which is an editing software, or Pro Tools, which is a sound mixing software. And you can get a user certificate, but if you want to get it on your own, it costs like $2,000.
Oh, okay.
So that's already, like, that's another barrier. So we thought, wouldn't it be cool to just kind of offer that certificate to participants? Of course, they have to pass the exam. We can't do that for them. But we are offering that class in both Pro Tools and Avid Media Composer. And then they can take the exam at no cost to them. So that's one of the benefits that we have for the Post-Production Diversity Institute. And the other one is one of the first people that I contacted was Muneeb Hassan, who works at the Motion Picture Editor Guild in New York. And I said, yeah, I mean, how would you feel about collaborating with us on this? And he was immediately like a very enthusiastic collaborator. Okay. And he was like, yeah, that would be great. You know, we'll have all these workshops. Well, I'll bring in, we have really great editors and sound mixers, and I can design a lecture series for you on Zoom. And then we'll also plan a trip to New York. You know, like, we can go to these post-production houses. So he was the first person that I actually talked with when we designed this. And then I also talked to my colleagues, especially Meg Knowles, who's also working at Buffalo State. So it kind of grew out of those conversations.
You know, there's a couple of a lot of elements inside this. There's the diversity part, but again, back to the whole post-production element. Let's make sure that everybody understands what we're talking about here. Post-production when it comes to the film industry, what are we talking about?
Well, this program covers like video editing, and we had some classes about sound editing for film, like people who are interested in pursuing like dialogue editing for film and TV shows. But we also cover people who are interested in digital music production.
Okay.
So in addition to like film and TV editing, we also have some people who produce their own music. We just took a trip to Mammoth Recording Studio locally, and we got to see their space where they record local artists and then kind of mix everything in Pro Tools, the software that Dorothea mentioned that we're training our participants in. So it actually covers a pretty wide range. And a lot of our Motion Picture Editors Guild instructors showed their workflow in the different editing softwares. So our first instructor was an assistant editor, and he helps go through all the footage and organize it so that when it gets to the video editor for the film or TV show, it's all organized for them and they don't have to look for where specific things are. Our second instructor was like a picture editor, so she focused on mainly cutting the whole project together, whatever it may be. And then we had some sound editing, sound design, like I mentioned. And most recently, we had a music editor who edits music in Pro Tools for film and TV. But it was cool because people who are interested in music production could also benefit from seeing how he operates in that software.
22 participants in this initiative. 11 of them are Buffalo State students. I guess I have to give a shout out to Kadara Wright, who's one of the participants, well, a Buffalo State student, and has been a tremendously valuable intern here at Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR. But also 11 community members were selected for this. One of them is Renato Graham, who's with us. Renato, all right, so what drew you into this particular initiative?
That's a good question. Because I think I was the first person that applied.
You were. Renato was the first one, and he not only emailed us, he also emailed the people in New York. They sent me an email and said, there's somebody who's already applying for this.
So. Well, we should tell everybody, I mean, you're a media professional as it is. You've already been, right? You don't like that term?
I feel like I just got started today.
Okay.
But I guess you could say that. I'm going to use the word pioneer in
all
a
right.
sense.
Okay.
Because when you say diversity, and I guess the president of the United States clearly is making that a thing, but I worked on jobs that I was the only minority.
Okay.
And I didn't have any real formal training. When I say that is, you can go to school, but you don't have any experience. And when you go on a job, you have to figure out how to fit around people that you don't know anything about their culture or them, if I can say that.
Sure.
It's like if I went to Japan, I was the only person that was American.
States, yep.
Let me just say that. And you don't know how to function. You don't know how to, and they don't know how to function with you. You know, because to be the only person of your kind, shall we say, on a job is brutal. You know, I remember when I got a job at Channel 4, they said, we don't normally hire people like you. I'm like, what are you talking about?
Whoa.
He said, production people.
Oh, okay.
So when you said, oh, that's what I thought. I'm like, wait a minute. The same thing happened to me when I applied at Channel 2. It was the same thing, in a sense. But, you know, when I came in Channel 4, they took me down to the newsroom and showed me the computer and sent me to work. Then one day they just said, hey, you know, the guy didn't show up for the live truck, run it.
Whoa.
And they gave me the keys, and it was kind of bootleg. You know, the switches weren't labeled or whatever, you know, whatever. So you had to figure it out. I like the program because the program is hands-on. They train you, and they take you on trips so you can do field trips, and you can see what it is you're going to be working in. And then I don't think a lot of people understand it. Personality has a lot to do with it, too. I used to work for Channel 17 many years ago on Barton Street, and it was kind of the same thing in a sense. No real training in it, you know, and I had to figure it out when I went there. I did Monday Night Football, HBO Boxing, a lot of things, and it was like, same thing. One minority, two minorities, very few people of color. And you had to figure it out. And, you know, now I teach in the Buffalo Public School System, and it's a special program. It's I work with a group called Wind Life, and we came in to teach life skills, and I started bringing some of my media equipment again. So it turned into a media program. And so we have about over $100,000 in media equipment in one of the public schools. You don't have to test into the school. So with my experience with the college, because I couldn't figure out what I was going to do with this program when they let me in.
Right.
And plus, I'm a little older. So I'm like, why did they pick me? Is one of my questions that I still have not answered yet. And I'm in
some
there.
Some questions are best not answered.
And the professor invited her to come to my class in the school, in the Buffalo Public School. Came in, exposed the kids to that. I want to try to tie the kids to the college so that they can have relationships and they would go to high school and eventually end up at college in this program. Because they, in eighth grade, some of my students don't even know what they want to do in life, period.
Sure.
So I think their program is important. People come in there and they're like, you got full podcasting. They're flying drones to fourth graders and commercial level drones. And they're like, why are you letting them touch your equipment? And because I didn't have no insurance at that time on them. And I like because I started when I was at Langston Hughes Institute when I was 13. And they exposed me to it. If they didn't expose me to it, what would I be doing now? I don't know. So the college, the program, I think my tie is a tie to Buffalo Public School kids have a relationship with the college. The college came to us, and hopefully we can go to the college. And that's something I don't think the school thought about. But I realize me being part of this, I don't know if I'm going to work for Netflix at my age at this particular point now. Maybe I will, maybe I won't.
But
I
yeah,
don't know.
You know, but you, since you brought up your age, what about the training on Avid and also Pro Tools? Is it, are you finding it relatively easy? I mean, you know,
and
they say older people.
I always wanted to do that.
Okay.
Avid and Pro Tools is extremely technical to me.
Okay.
You know, and to a lot of people to use the equipment. But that's the standard. You have to learn it.
Sure.
So I always wanted to learn it. I never really I dabbed in it, whatever. I never did it. But I think this is the opportunity for me to learn that and master that skill. And even if I don't do it, I can teach my students.
Okay.
So I think that's good.
Talk about the diversity of the program, though, right? So I said 22, 11 students, 11
yeah.
community members.
I think age diversity is super important, and we all felt that is an important factor also. It's kind of ironic that in some ways we glorify our youth in our society, But the people that have more stories to tell are older people. So why not give access to them also to the media equipment? And Renato is not the oldest in our program. I think it brings it adds depth to the experience, and makes it more community centered. I think. I don't know what you think about this, Robin, but. So that's one level of diversity, but I love the fact that Renato is going back to the Buffalo Public School and kind of creating a little ecosystem of knowledge. I mean, I think shared knowledge is power. You know, like you share your knowledge and you spread it around. Another really great point that you brought up is the access to the equipment. There's a lot of film programs that require you to make a short film to get admitted. Well, that means that you must have, you know, Adobe Premiere somewhere in your house or something already before you even apply to the film program. I think that's not fair. I think people that don't have access to editing equipment should also have access to a media education. And Buffalo State has a very strong record of being very inclusive, I think. And I think that's why this program is very well suited to be in Buffalo State.
We're talking about the Post-Production Diversity Initiative at Buffalo State University. Dorothea Brayman with us, also Robin Lazara and Renato Graham. I want to just kind of circle back a little bit to the discussion, and you touched on it, everybody's kind of touched on it a little bit, and I'll open it up here. But the idea of why it is important to have a more diverse workforce in media production, and in terms of storytelling, like you said, you know, if you're older, you've got more stories to tell. I find that not everybody wants to listen to my stories. But that being stated, but how about for you? You know, Robin, you know, getting in, you obviously are, you know, you got your own initiatives besides this as well. What about that idea that what are you seeing maybe developing, maybe not only among the initiative students, but some of your colleagues as well? And, you know, comparing it to what has been the media stereotypes, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, I think representation is super important, not only in front of the camera, like the characters that you see on screen. I feel like the people working behind the camera being represented is just as important, because like Renato teaches younger people, they want to look at and see people that look like them working in the field and doing what they want to pursue doing. And everybody has different stories to tell. So even though editing can be a super technical job, it really could come down to just storytelling. Mm-hmm. Because you could be working for like a newsroom, or you could be working on a narrative project where you're telling a story. And I just think it makes... This is going to sound so corny, but that's I feel fine. Like it makes the world a better place.
I like that.
When everybody is represented, and everybody has a say in decisions that are being made. And it's not just the same people doing the same thing over and over again and shutting people out. I've worked a bit in the film industry, more on set than like editing on big projects. And I would look around and always see like the same people. So it's really important to me to help people who are aspiring to get into film, to connect them with people who are already doing it, to learn about, oh, like if you were just starting out, what do you wish you could have done differently? Like asking experienced people these questions, and just kind of learning from them to help them get to where they want to be.
Any other thoughts about that? Especially the thought about, you know, having different people involved in the process. I mean, you know, Renato, you were sharing your experience earlier about what it was like showing up at some of these job sites to do this work, and you're the only minority on set.
Yeah, it hasn't got a little better. I followed DeMiro around, Mayor Brown around for 4 years, doing media for him, and a lot of places we went, I was the only minority, me and him. And I explained to people something really important. You know, when there was critical on Byron, I was hired on him too, until I realized in the history of Buffalo, that was established, I don't know, in the 1700s, 1800s, whatever. He's the first minority man of color ever in the history of the world to be a mayor here in Buffalo. And when I say it like that, people are like, wow. And, you know, we was running around. It was like me and him donate some time in at places. And I don't think people realize that. And the qualifications of me working, a lot of times, who can I learn from?
Right.
You know, I don't see anybody like me, and I'm the only one on the job. So I guess I was a pioneer in the thing. So when I talk to the students, I try to prepare them that you can't walk around with your hands in your pocket. You can't wait for somebody else to tell you how to do something. You're going to have to figure it out. And a lot of these kids can't figure it out. Their attention spans are so short now that but one thing shocking to me at the school system was some kids was walking by the classroom. I started last year, and they were walking by, and I'm new to the school system. And they're really young. They're like fourth graders or something. And they popped in, was curious of what was going on in my room because they seen the equipment. They came in, and I said, they can stay. They're not bothering me. We went outside and flew the drone the first day. And they knew what they were doing. And we assumed they weren't capable. The older they get, it's difficult. But the younger, they do whatever you ask. And they're amazing. And they're teaching me stuff on the iPad and all kind of stuff. I'm assuming, wait a minute, you're a little kid, don't touch that. And I'm like, wait a minute, now I'm calling them over talking about how do you do this? So we need to start preparing them now before the world messed them up. And I'm not trying to get into politics, but I think when I watch the news, they're talking about cutting all the art funding. In public broadcasting and whatever. Like, I did work at Channel 17, so I did benefit from it. I worked at the first public access in Buffalo, so I did benefit from all of this. But, so that's important. I'm just plugged. Fun arts in the program.
I think, I mean, access to the arts is so important and being inclusive. Another example that I thought of is music mixing, like mixing audio. And we are also collaborating with digital music with Tomas Henriquez, the professor there, just to mention that. But even in our program, all the people that were doing music mixing were, you know, white guys. And it's a very, very gendered profession.
Okay.
But you actually, Morgan Koziel is working here, right?
Yep.
She's part of the program also. And to break that gender barrier with music mixing is extremely important, I think. Not just sound mixing, I mean, not just music. So that's another example where we just need more diversity. Every study shows that a more diverse environment creates better outcomes. School, if a school is diverse, the learning outcomes go up. And I think that's true for every environment. You need to have an inclusive environment because shared knowledge is more knowledge, you know.
And another thing that you mentioned, I think before we went on the air, Renato was somewhat touched upon it, the idea that, okay, you can get an A in a class, right? And you can get all the good grades you want, but there is that extra, that little something that is needed if you're going to advance in this field.
Yeah, I mean, I love what Renato was saying about you don't really, like, if you're the only one in a situation, it's like it's very hard to figure out how do I fit in. And to just kind of figure out how do I fit into this ecosystem of post-production and how do I behave? We talked about getting into the film industry, it's also a personality issue. I would say it's an attitude issue. Like, you have to have the attitude of being curious, of being able to present yourself in a positive light also without nonstop boasting or something like that. But you have to present yourself. I think that's another thing that you have to learn, especially if you've been taught a lot that you're supposed to be humble and quiet, you know, or something like along those lines. I mean, that's why we have these portfolio classes with Atina Ferret Cook, who's part of the initiative, and she really honed in on the lesson that it's okay to talk about yourself and a kind of define yourself before other people define you. That's another issue that a lot of minorities have. It's like others are filling in for you because they're so used to be to doing that. So you define yourself and you present yourself to society in a way that facilitates engagement and dialogue. And those are all skills that are, like, they're not only important for post-production, obviously, they're life skills.
Right.
And I'm hoping that, you know, people are learning skills that will help them navigate the environment regardless of what they're going to be doing later on.
We're winding down to our couple minutes here of talking about the Post-Production Diversity Initiative. And I know this is year one. We don't know if there's going to be a year two, but we're already looking, hoping,
yeah,
keeping our fingers crossed and doing all the grant work to see if we can get another year.
Yeah, we're really hoping that we're able to do this again. After actually doing it for a year, we obviously learned a lot, and there's a lot that we would improve going forward. But when we initially opened applications last year, we had over 50 people apply. So that helps show that there's a need for this. And we were initially planning on only accepting 18 participants, but since so many people applied, we increased it to 22 because we were like...
And it's worked out. 22 has been okay. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, it's been really great. So fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed.
We already have a lot of people that are interested to apply for the second year. So there is interest, there's need for that kind of education, I think.
And how about this for a final question? I'll pose each of you to go this through. What for you, how does this program, how can it be judged a success? What do you think, Renato?
A lot of people I talk to, they're like, I didn't hear about that. How come I, you know, so they want to be part of it because it's exciting to them. And all my students, they're all excited. But a lot of people, when I tell them about the program, they want to be part of it. But there's not enough cheers. But if there's one improvement I could say for the program.
There we go.
I couldn't get into the building because I wasn't a student. All the outsiders are like, who are you? Where's your
ID? You got access, but not building access.
I did. So we was working on that.
And that's something we talked about for next year, partnering with some local organizations.
Because the police didn't know what to do with me. You're not a student. Where's your ID?
So he can only get in when the program is running. And there's bureaucratic obstacles.
Sure, but back to success. For you, what is it? How do you judge success in this program?
Well, there's a requirement from New York State that we have to track everyone for like 5 years.
Oh, wow.
and see what they're going to do. So that there's that kind of measurable sort of success. Like, what are these people going to do? And I'm kind of curious. I want to stay in touch just to see, you know, what are you going to do with this? Another success for me is how much community are we creating through this program? How much fellowship are we creating? And, you know, I've seen bonds made between Buffalo State students and community members already kind of in a way that I think is meaningful. So that is also success. And just to see Robin in action has been, you know, really great. So success to me is, you know, like that the people will stay engaged and in a meaningful way. That to me is would be success.
And Robin, how about for you? Success for this program? How does it look for you?
Yeah, honestly, I feel like after we have like a Zoom session with the Motion Picture Editors Guild or like one of our creative portfolio classes, and I hear some of the participants talk about how they learned a lot and they really enjoyed it and like they really liked the instructor, or like Dorothea was talking about how a lot of people are introverted and like nervous to talk about themselves and what they do, even if they're super passionate about it. I watched them throughout the course of these creative portfolio classes gain confidence in themselves, and like they're all working towards creating a website to share their work. So I feel like I celebrate those small successes after every class where people took something away, because that's like watching them grow and learn in real time. And it's really cool that this program offers all of these opportunities free of charge.
Well, it was a great discussion. We're going to have to limit it right there, but I appreciate everybody's time here talking about this as well. And good luck with that grant for year two. We'll have to see what happens there, but I have a feeling I've got a good feeling about this.
How's that sound?
Yeah, for sure.
Thank you.
With us, Dorothea Bramer, also Robin Lazara and Renato Graham, this morning talking about the Post-Production Diversity Initiative. This has been What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.